This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's dive right in with our Week in Review. In Boston, you can watch the commercials for blazing fiber optic cable, but you still can't get it.
Experience the difference of fiber optics straight to your door. The fastest internet, period.
Well, period, yes, because you can't get it in Boston. Also, nearly 5 years after a patient died at a state mental hospital, family members and now the governor are looking for answers.
The bottom line is I blame Bridgewater and I blame the guards.
And the opiate addiction epidemic continues. Revere Fire Captain Jay Piccarello says it's cheap, dangerous, and responsible. That is heroin, specifically, responsible for 15 overdoses in his city in just 6 days.
The heroin seems to be pure today, and it's cut with fentanyl and causing some problems for us.
And in Boston, Mayor Marty Walsh has promised a more diverse city hall.
It's important to make sure that we reflect Boston in my administration, and we will in my cabinet, and we will in my throughout the administration.
But his hires so far, perhaps not as diverse as promised. We'll dig into all these stories now with our Week in Review panel this week. Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe. Hi there, Dante.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, but stumbling over my words already this hour. I'm sorry, it's been a bit of a tongue-tied week for me. With me also in the studio is Mike Ross, former city councilman and now an attorney at Prince Lobel. Mike, great to have you.
Good to be back. Great to be here.
So let's first start off with the question of high-speed internet and what we can't and can't get around Boston, because we're used to thinking about the city as the tip of the spear when it comes to great technology, biotech companies, robotics firms, hospitals, great institutions of higher learning. But in a big announcement from Google this week, and also given the fact that there's a mega merger, perhaps in the works between Time Warner Cable and Comcast, all this has underscored what residents in Boston have long known, that actually when it comes to truly high-speed internet in the city, there aren't many great options. So many people remember that commercial shot in Boston featuring Donnie Wahlberg.
This is New England, where people tell it straight. No phonies, no fakers, no shortcuts. Verizon Fios never takes shortcuts either. That's why they built the only 100% fiber optic network in Massachusetts and brought you America's fastest, most reliable internet. So we can stream online videos faster and watch all of our teams in unbeatable picture quality.
Maybe someone ought to call Donnie up, because they never actually wired up Boston with fiber optic cable. And the company took a lot of heat for that ad anyway from the mayor and others. So, Mike, let's start with you. I mean, you've written about Boston's failure on fiber. First of all, why has it happened and what's at stake here?
Well, it's a few things. I mean, some of it has to do with Verizon. I mean, they're not here, and so they're not an option. And so that if you somehow can't get Comcast into your building, which is possible because everywhere there are going to be pockets where there aren't connectivity, then what is your option? It gets very expensive. I mean, you can put some sort of something on your roof, satellite, very costly. You can start trenching yourself, very, very costly.
Right.
So Comcast, by the way, has been great about this. They have been finding those kind of pockets that don't exist, not just downtown, but in our neighborhoods, and they're getting there. But there just isn't that second choice. And the other thing is some of the, you know, what we're hearing with Google Fiber, they're not in Boston.
No, and apparently they don't want to come. Yeah.
And they don't want to come because of a number of reasons. First of all, it's hard to wire out a city like Boston. Our geographical challenges, our older infrastructure, but then also the permitting, and that it's hard to open up our roads, and that it's expensive to get those permits. And all those things make it harder to get wired in Boston. It's much easier to do it in, say, Provo, Utah, where they are, and other places where grid cities, and just, you know, get in there, get out, and wire up their city. So Marty Walsh seemed to signal that something was coming at a recent breakfast in front of business leaders, saying, I can't talk about it now, but just wait and stay tuned. We'll see, but I'm not holding my breath.
Well, Dante, let me turn to you. I mean, what do you think is at stake here if Boston doesn't get a super high-speed fiber optic broadband for a long time?
Well, Meghna, you mentioned the robotics factories and the institutions of higher learning, and you know, you theoretically could have those things connected by dirt roads and horse-drawn carriages, but like, and you know, some stuff would get done and it wouldn't grind productivity to a halt, but you know, there's obviously a situation where you know, it just becomes kind of sand in the works. It makes it difficult for people to do things online and just makes it a little bit more of a hassle. And it means that every time somebody in some startup company is trying to test out something, it takes an extra second or two for something to load. I mean, it just makes it a little bit more of a hassle to do business here. And that's a real problem. You know, like Mike says, we're in a bad situation that we're not really in a great position to solve. The hope was that somebody like Google would come in here like a knight in shining armor and string out a bunch of fiber optics. But it just, you know, it isn't likely to happen for all the reasons that he mentioned. You know, the in addition to digging up the roads, you know, the political climate seems to require that you have police details out there. And it's something that, you know, there's a lot of little reasons that add up to a big problem here. I don't know what Marty Walsh's secret plan to end the broadband mess here is, but you almost think that it needs to be something big. I mean, I don't know if there's some possibility of having a business improvement district in the innovation district that actually, you know, just for that part of the city will intensify broadband connections, or if you could do the same thing in Kendall Square, or if we're waiting on big advances in wireless internet. But it's got to be something big that breaks through the status quo.
So, Mike, let me ask you. I mean, Dante mentioned the potential impact on business, but for many years now, lots of people, including many high-profile politicians in Massachusetts, have talked about the fact that really getting high-speed broadband to, you know, individuals and families, especially those in low-income neighborhoods, is really important to sort of bridge the technology gap there. And, I mean, in fact, Mayor Marty Walsh told the Massachusetts Technology Leadership Council, I think that's what you were mentioning, this month, that he was going to do more. So, you know, if you could wave a magic wand over City Hall, what would you have him do?
I think Wi-Fi and you know, let the market do this. I mean, government is not good at doing this, you know. So at one point, I think Mayor Menino's administration, I think, might have brought Wi-Fi rollout in a little too close to them. And then they owned it. And it was just there is some great work happening, but it's very slow and steady, and it needs to be a lot faster. Let the market, you know, liberalize the market, let the infrastructure get out there, make the permitting process easier, But, you know, I think to your point earlier, a lot of these companies want to come in and just wire out the downtown and leave, and they want to leave all our neighborhoods unwired. And some of that is where this fight was with some of these companies to begin with. I wasn't part of that conversation, but I suspect that might have some of something what's going on with the Verizon piece. So, you know, but if we can make it easier for companies to come in, not charge them an arm and a leg, essentially, to wire our city, work out a deal with them, I think you might be able to see the city get wired for high-speed internet connections.
All right. Well, let's move on to another topic entirely that's been much in the news this week. And that is Governor Deval Patrick said yesterday that he wants a complete accounting from the Department of Corrections regarding what happened in the aftermath of a 2009 death of a patient at the Bridgewater State Hospital.
There are issues in terms of the length of time it took to report on it properly, which are serious questions, and they need to be asked, and I have asked them.
And once again, a little background to that is that the case involved the death of Joshua Messier, who was killed as seven guards bound his hands and feet to a small bed. And Messier's mother, Lisa Brown, spoke with Radio Boston on Monday, and she said that there were many questions about who is responsible for her son's death.
Why nobody's been punished, why they haven't been prosecuted, why we don't have pictures of them right in the beginning up on the news. If it was anybody else being accused of a crime, our pictures would be up there.
And Dante, let me come to you, because the great reporting on this came out of the Globe, and through the Globe's reporting, we found out that protocol is that reports are supposed to be filed at the end of every shift at Bridgewater State Hospital. But in the case of Messier, it took 3 years to do so. I mean, so first of all, what's your big picture thinking on what we've learned from the terrible aftermath or the terrible fact of this case to begin with?
I think there are two main features to this case. One, is the utter lack of accountability for law enforcement. And by law enforcement, I mean the guards at the hospital and the district attorney who made the decision not to prosecute, and for the medical examiner who took back the decision that it was a homicide. I mean, there's no real way for the outside world to hold that accountable, seemingly, for what is clearly a lapse in protocol. The other thing I would say is that the deeper problem here is that there's been a conflation of law enforcement with mental health treatment. Bridgewater mm-hmm. State Hospital is basically a prison, but it's got the criminally insane there, and then it has people who have severe psychological problems or mental problems that their families can't manage and that may manifest as punching a doctor or a guard or something like that, but isn't, you know, basic criminal or what most people think of as criminal activity as opposed to a behavioral problem. And the guards at Bridgewater, at least from the story, seem to be behaving like standard prison guards. It's not as though they have any particular therapeutic expertise, but on the other hand, prison guards, if you believe the story that we had in the paper, you know, are also trained not to use this particular technique. So it's really the worst of both worlds, and then you add that to the lack of accountability. It's a real nightmare scenario.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, in this case, I mean, there's the bigger issue as well of the fact that, you know, what protections or should let me back up here. I'm sorry, Dante. Should Joshua Messier have even been in Bridgewater State? I mean, he was a paranoid schizophrenic because at the Bridgewater State Hospital is a medium security prison. And, you know, were there other options available around the state? I mean, there constantly seems to be this question of are members of this vulnerable population, you know, really receiving the care and attention that they're needing in the best way possible, given what Massachusetts could potentially offer them?
It's kind of a cliche that law enforcement becomes the mental health service of last resort, but this is really a clear illustration of that situation, because it does seem as though a place like Bridgewater is definitely not the right setting for somebody who, again, has somewhat violent behavior tendencies but hasn't been accused of a severe crime. They end up in a situation that is just not really clinically appropriate.
Right. Now, Mike, kind of oddly, there was another story this week that had to do with prisoners and restraints in Massachusetts, because Governor Deval Patrick basically announced emergency guidelines to eliminate the use of restraints on pregnant inmates who are in labor, and he urged the legislature to pass a bill that would permanently ban that practice. So your thoughts on that story?
I think this is one of those things that most Bostonians and people from Massachusetts heard this and couldn't believe that this is not already a law, that somehow a woman giving birth could actually be in handcuffs in 2014 is outrageous to think that this can happen. And yet, in fact, this law has been languishing for years in the state house.
10 years, in fact. Yeah.
You know, and it really makes you wonder, how is that possible? I heard on this station an interview of a woman who went through that, who was forced to give birth or almost give birth in handcuffs, and go through all of that entails in handcuffs. Mm. Finally, I think her they released her. But I mean, this just shouldn't be allowed to be. So, yeah, the governor has an executive order that will immediately change that. But I think that law needs to pass immediately.
Well, let's move on now to the exploding opiate addiction crisis across New England communities. In Taunton, more than 60 people have overdosed since December. Huge number there, 5 deaths. And in Revere, 15 overdose calls in the past week alone. And there have been 7 overdose deaths in Rhode Island in the past 5 days. So on Radio Boston, we spoke with Dr. Haider Varaich, who's at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He had written an op-ed in the Globe this week about the connection between heroin and legal opiates. And he shared with us this staggering fact.
The United States accounts for 4.5% of the world's population, but consumes 80% of the world's opiate supply, which is a huge disparity to me.
Is that legal opiates or not legal and non-legal?
All opiates. Okay. All opiates.
So Dante, basically the doctor, he was pointing to a part of the picture that he's familiar with, and that is how easy it is to get prescription opiates in the United States. But I wonder, when it comes to how the problem ripples out across communities, I mean, is the state, can the state or individual cities and towns do more? Because I guess a lot of the heroin, for example, out there right now is laced with fentanyl, a substance that's making it deadly.
It seems as though this heroin problem, it's something that seems to ebb and flow, but obviously there's been a lot of attention given to it lately, and it does seem as though, you know, just looking at it from the 30,000-foot level, that there is really something unusual that's different from past experiences. I hesitate to make too much of this, but all of the places that we've been talking about, Taunton, Revere has come up, Rhode Island, rural Vermont, these are all places where, you know, there's not that much going on economically, and people feel like they don't have great prospects. And you have to wonder a little bit whether there's some connection between this deeper unease that people are feeling about the course of society or the trajectory of society and their own ability to get caught in this web of addiction. It's hard to draw a connection, but that pattern seems striking to me.
Mike, your thoughts?
I mean, this is a growing problem as more and more of these opiate-like prescriptions are being put out in the marketplace, and this is a strange backlash. I'm actually really optimistic about an announcement that actually Mayor Marty Walsh just made about requiring first responders to carry overdose reversal medication.
Right.
You know, and starting to treat these problems, and even the last thing we were talking about, mental illness, drug addiction, treating these problems not from a criminal justice approach, but from a public health approach, getting people into recovery, getting people into treatment, that is how we're going to cure this problem. We're not going to be able to wrest our way out of it.
Mm. Now, we've got just enough time today to talk about our hubbubs, and that's the story that maybe wasn't top of mind for everyone this week. And Dante, you get to kick us off. What's your hubbub?
Okay, well, if you're on the highway after any snowstorm, you'll notice there's always one car that has its own window scraped clean, but there is a huge glacier of snow on its roof. But under a new law in Connecticut, it took effect just this January 1st, hundreds of drivers are being fined for creating what they call ice missiles. These are the big chunks of snow that fly off hit other vehicles and sometimes hit the windshield. Now, to me, there's something melodramatic about the term ice missiles, because you imagine Dr. Strangelove throwing icicles at people or the Hartford missile crisis. But it's a real problem, particularly as it relates to the trucking industry. A lot of people have been upset about that. But it's, if nothing else, it's a reminder that if you can't clean off the roof of the car that you're driving, you maybe ought to consider driving something else.
I still like ice missiles. It's attention grabbing, and I think it's a problem that deserves people to pay attention to. Okay, Mike, what's your hubbub?
Well, this one's more serious, making up for some of the goofy ones I've brought in the past, but it's a good one. Page 2 of the Metro today has this, of Boston Globe, has this great photo of a police officer, Deputy Superintendent Nora Bastin, looking at a cell phone with a young kid from Dorchester.
Right, they're sitting on the side of a basketball court.
Yeah, and he's got a basketball in his hand. And I wanted to know what she was doing, so I called her up and spoke to her. Now, I know Deputy Superintendent Nora Bastin. Most people in Boston who pay attention closely know her because of the amazing work she's doing in the community. And what she was doing was getting the cell phone number and giving her cell phone number to this kid, someone she just met minutes ago. She also gave him $5, and she sent him off to go look at the Madison Park basketball game later that night, which she said she would be at too. Guess what? He was there, ran up to her, hugged her. This is a new relationship. She's doing that kid by kid by kid across the city. This woman is amazing. Watch her. She's doing great things. And that was the story behind that photo. Nora Bastin, Deputy Superintendent of the Boston Police Department.
Well, great story, great work by Deputy Superintendent, and great photo. And if you want to see it, we've tweeted or retweeted that photo. You can follow us at Radio Boston. My hubbub is a short one. I'm in an Olympics frame of mind this week, so mine has to do with hockey. The U.S. men faced off against Canada today. Not saying what happened there, but I don't know if you heard about this. In Chicago, there was this big billboard that had two pictures of a Canadian hockey player and an American men's hockey player, and in the middle there was Justin Bieber.
That's right.
Because it said the loser gets to keep Bieber. So that's how high the stakes are when it comes to Olympic hockey between the U.S. and Canada.
So did somebody throw the game?
No spoilers today on Radio Boston. And that's it for the Week in Review today. Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe. Thanks as always, Dante.
Thank you.
And Mike Ross, former Boston City Councilor and Attorney at Prince Lobel. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.